You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And of course, being the second Wednesday of the month, it's time for our legal hour with the guys. Well, they are guys this week from Hutchison Legal. We've got Con, who we've had many times, so it's good to see you, Con.
Good to be back, Alan.
Always have a lot of fun with you. And Sam, who we had here last month, and Sam, I believe, is it's not work experience, is it?
It's work experience with a different title, pretty much, yeah.
Same sort of thing.
Yeah.
All right, so I believe, Sam, we talked about the last week about a pipe burst in the street, and does it then, and if it goes under the crossing into your house, is it an easement, and therefore if the water company have to smash it to repair it, who's the responsibility of it? So, and also, does that mean that if it is an easement, that one side, because the pipes only go down one side of the road, does that mean one side's an easement, the other side's under different rules? So, Sam, let us know.
Let me know. Oh, but let me know. No, I'll let you know. So, from what I found out, so the bit, here's my fact of the day alone, the bit that connects your road to the street, so the concrete part that's a driveway, that is called the crossover.
Yep.
And the crossover, anything that's not your land is the council's land. And that includes the crossover. That part on the nature strip to the front of your property, yeah, your cars drive over, that belongs to the council.
So it doesn't alter because it's an easement, like because it's got water under it?
I don't believe it's an easement. That term, really, please pick me up, Con, if I say something wrong. But in like land law, that's if someone has a right to something on your property. That's different.
Is it? Right.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah. So easement probably isn't the right term. It's all that's the reason this answer is kind of boring, is because everything that happens on council land, that's going to be council responsibility, and is good. And
it's boring.
And with the water pipes, if it's before the meter, and yep, you haven't altered it in any way before the meter,
yep,
water company responsibility.
Yep.
So a pipe burst underneath your crossover, it's on council land, on the part of the water pipe that the water company is responsible for. That's their problem. That's their responsibility to fix and mend.
Yeah, that's so, a water company. But yeah, then whose responsibility to fix the crossover?
It's all council property.
Well, so it'll be if the water company needs to dig it up to get to the pipe,
yep,
then the water company will have to reinstate it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, but
so
the point, I think the point that the person rang in said, well, it's been concrete forever, and all they've done is put dirt back in with a little bit of gravel on the top, and they say, well, that's reinstated. But is that reinstated?
Well, no, well, if it's not like it was before, you can't use the word reinstated. It's it's a temporary driveway, not a permanent concrete driveway that used to be there previously. But so, yes, that's what needs to happen. So whether it's gas, water, anything that's coming from the street, from the nature strip, yep, from the public services into your property, yeah, up to the meter, yep, or that little bit into the land, they've got to fix that. The footpaths, and whoever's damaging it needs to reinstate it to the way it was.
To the way it was.
Yes.
All right, that sounds good. So it wasn't so boring after all. That's it, is it?
Oh yeah. That's all I have.
I did want to add a real life story to this issue of where is the boundary,
yeah,
and where's your land?
Yep.
Because I've seen in a number of situations where you've got the green grass of the nature strip, you've got the concrete footpath,
yep,
and then sometimes you've got another small,
yep,
strip of grass.
Yep.
Sometimes people have put rocks on it,
yep,
and sometimes people have built little retaining walls on it, like two or three bricks high.
Yep.
That's not your land. So from the edge of the concrete drop, between the concrete footpath,
yeah,
and your land, there's about a foot, maybe,
is it,
of land that's still the council's land. It's not yours.
Because a lot of people build their fences on it.
Well, that's right, and they shouldn't. And we've had cases where council have come along and said, remove it. It's on council property. So be very careful to make sure you get that right, because, as I say, you can... It can happen for years and years. People just walk by it. But there should, in most cases, be a gap between the edge of the concrete footpath and your property.
So I guess when you're buying a property, they're always telling us to make sure the measures were right. So we should also be checking where the front of the block checks starts.
Exactly,
too,
exactly right. And you should be checking where the fences are, and you should be checking, because if the fence has been there for more than 15 years, the neighbour might have an adverse possession claim into your land.
Does that apply to the council part as well?
No, you can't adverse possess against the council.
Can't you?
No.
Who decides that?
Well, they wanted to make sure that because councils have a hard time keeping up with everything, so they can't keep track of everyone breaching.
And that would be
their boundaries
with state government on Crown land, wouldn't it?
You can't adverse possess, generally speaking, there against council or Crown land. So that's something to keep in mind, though. But yes, you should very carefully go and measure, get a proper plan from the titles office, get a surveyor to mark it out, because it can lead to a lot of problems later on if you don't get that sorted out.
Sure. All right, we'll take a quick break. So that's the answer for the people. We've got another set of questions for you to take away, but we'll give you those at just on 2 o'clock.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And hello, Grant, if you happen to be listening or if you hear us on the podcast. Now, we want to talk a bit. You've got a case of discrimination that we'd like to talk about.
Yeah, so something that came up recently in the Museum of Old and New Art.
Museum of Old and New Art,
that's
Mona.
That's it, Mona, in Tasmania, in Hobart. Yeah. Very popular, very controversial, known for doing a lot of controversial pieces of art down there. Thought-provoking, some would say, and some would say offensive. So everyone's got different opinions. Recently it was in the news for... it created a thing called the Ladies' Lounge, and only ladies were allowed in, except the male butlers who were serving drinks and food to the ladies. Right. And a visitor from New South Wales, and he happened to have the same name as one of our partners, and but it wasn't him.
No, it wasn't with your partner,
definitely wasn't him. But this fellow complained that he was being discriminated against. Why aren't I allowed into the Ladies' Lounge? Well, So arguments were put that this is a piece of art. It's meant
and
to
so
be,
this went to court?
It went to the Tasmanian Civil and Administrative Tribunal, like our VCAT.
Yep.
I think it's called TASCAT down there.
TASCAT.
So, and he complained, and it was ruled that it was discriminatory. Now, people got a lot of different views on this as to whether that's the right outcome or not, because I think I would hope people could understand we discriminate a lot in our society and in our laws, and there's good reason to do so. There's an exemption was applied for a long time ago for Fernwood gyms to have women's only gyms.
Yep.
But the law basically starts with the position of everything's discriminatory and is banned, but there are exemptions.
Oh, so it doesn't go the other way, that everybody should be able to do everything and then you put the exemptions on.
Yeah, no, sorry. Yeah, so it starts with there should be no discrimination of any kind. Sorry, I got it wrong.
Yep.
No discrimination of any kind whatsoever.
Yep.
So that means that AFL should be men and women mixed together.
Yep.
So only the best play. That's the starting position. But then we say, wait a minute, there's good reason to discriminate. We should, for AFL football, we should discriminate between men and women.
Yep.
And that's been the case for many sports over many years. And like I said, with the gym, I think years ago there was the Fitzroy swimming pool, the public bath there, and a group of Muslim women wanted 2 hours for themselves.
Yep.
Now, the starting position would be, well, that would be discriminatory to keep other people out. But then we always find a way to say something should be an exception, something should be an exemption from the general principle that you're not allowed to discriminate at all. So, and the worst kind of discrimination I find is that if you don't have enough money, you can't have a Porsche. I think that's terrible discrimination based on your financial circumstances. But we discriminate all the time based on what you can afford. We have seniors pricing.
Yep.
We have adult pricing. We have children pricing.
Yep.
And we say, well, on face value, that's discriminatory between people based on age.
Yeah.
That's not fair, but we allow it. So just because somebody uses the word discrimination doesn't always mean it's a bad thing. Many circumstances, it's a good thing. But in this particular case, I'm not so sure I'm offended by the idea of a ladies' lounge. I'm not upset by it, but this man was, and it was found that the law said, no, you can't do it. So just always keep in mind, is this a good discrimination or a bad discrimination?
What was the outcome? Was
he won the case. Yep. They had to allow men in.
Yeah.
They had 28 days to change what they were doing.
I think it's currently on appeal, though, from what I read on the news, at least.
Okay, so that'll be interesting.
They're not bringing up the fight, so watch this space, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because you can't... I mean, one of the things that the governments have been very strong of late is that you can't discriminate on ground land. I know that the governments have been sort of knocking down any, like some of these where there were men's clubs on Crown land.
They've been saying,
well, no, you can't do that. If it's Crown land, it's available to
everyone,
both male and female.
Sure.
All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be back with more.
You're always on the run now, running after somebody.
to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, I believe there's been some changes to family law, because I remember a number of years ago, and I don't want to get political, but I think it might have been the Howard years, brought in that there should be 50-50 in the case of a divorce with the child, that they spend, you know, a week here, a week there, or 2 weeks here, whatever it was, 50-50. In some cases, that caused a lot of trouble because some of the parents lived miles apart and the child had to keep changing school and backwards and forwards. So I believe that they've now changing the rules, aren't they, Con?
Yeah, yes, that's right. We have a great lawyer, Andrew Wheeler, and his team at Hutchinson Legal. Andrew's an accredited specialist, so he'll correct me if I get any of this wrong. But no, there has been changes that are starting. Well, they started on the 6th of May, so this
they're
week
in.
They're in. And what's changed is that they've removed the starting presumption that there should be equal shared parental responsibility. So instead of starting with that and then finding reasons to adjust it, what they've decided to say is that it's... You look at the best interests of the child, and that's where you start.
In what ways, Con?
Well,
everything?
They've also changed a little. Tried to simplify what that means. What are the best interests of a child?
Yep.
To try and help parties understand, look, this is how we're going to make a decision about who has the kids and when.
Yep.
We're going to start with what's in the child's best interests and determine. And that may lead to outcomes where the child is with one parent pretty much most of the time, because it's seen as in the best interest of the child. And so that's what it doesn't start with the 50-50 shared care or shared decision making or things like that. It's always going to be who, in the circumstances of that particular family, what are the best interests of the child and who should be making the decisions for that child. But it's always been the case that best interests of the child have been looked at, but more weight was given to the idea that 50-50. If you start at 50-50 and then adjust from there, if there's reasons to adjust. And now it's going to be, well, it might be just that, well, the parties have allowed the children to stay with that parent most of the time for the last year.
Yep.
That seems to be what's best for the child. We're going to leave it like that. We're not going to push it to a 50-50.
All right, so I'm going to be the devil's advocate.
Yep.
There's a divorce and they can't agree. On the basis of 50-50, well, they both knew what they were going to get. So what do you got to do? Rock up to the family court? And what does the family court judge? How are they going to decide? It's all right to say what's in the best interest of the child, but how, particularly if the child's 5 or 6, can't speak up necessarily for themselves. So how does the magistrate or the judge, how do they make the decision?
Well, there are factors in the Act. I'm sorry, I don't know them off the top of my head, but they'll be wanting to know. Yet different ages will affect the decision as well.
Yep.
As as I say, past history will play into it as to the parties seem to have already agreed, or by their actions, they've already seemed to agree that the current arrangements are probably the best.
I'm talking about ones that can't agree.
But then, if you want to fight against that, then yes, you have to justify that things should be changed because it would be better for the child to change the current arrangements. And that's always a difficult debate, and especially where you have situations about, you know, certain kinds of medical treatment or being vaccinated for, you know, a flu vax, for example, or some other medical treatment or intervention. One parent might say, definitely no, that my child shouldn't have that. It's not in their interest. And another parent will say, definitely must happen.
So what factors would a judge have to take into the thought process to make the decision? Because he or she might be the one that has to make the decision.
The judges have a difficult job, but they'll have to make a call on this is better than that. The child's interests are better served by having the medical treatment.
And the judge's view is going to be guided, hopefully, by the legislation.
Mm.
And the legislation will say, these are the factors you may consider, and they put weight to those. So they still are guided by law, but it is the judge's job to judge.
Yeah, it must be fairly hard, though, when you've got two opposing sides, and one says, well, well, let's take just something silly, like a flu injection. Mm. One says they're not going to have it. The other one says it does. Mm. Well, I'm not sure how a judge can come to a decision, to be honest with you.
Well, they're going, if they've looked at the overall situation, it might be a consequence of, well, we've decided that it's in the best interest for the child to be with that parent.
Right.
Most of the time, we're going to let that parent make those decisions, is probably the way that they'll go, rather than picking and choosing on individual issues. Yeah. But it can get very complicated. For example, you might have a family where the child was being sent, both parents previously agreed to send a child to an independent religious school.
Right.
But then there's the breakup, yep, the divorce, and then there's a parent that becomes very anti the child going to that school.
Yep.
What happens? What's in the best interest of the child? Keeping them in the school that they've been at for many, many years, or taking them out of there? And so the court might be asked to intervene in that situation, because you might have this conflict of, oh, we've decided the child should be with that parent, but we don't agree with that parent taking them out of the school that they've been at for 10 years already. Yeah. So it's very very complicated.
I just want to throw...
Get advice is all I'd say, and from Andrew Wheeler and his team.
I just want to throw another thing into the course. Say they front up at court and they've been in a private school, and now the divorce has come along. Mm-hmm. One says, well, the child has to stay in there because that's what they want. And one partner says, well, I haven't got the money anymore to pay my share.
Mm, that's very tricky as well. So, I think if you can persuade it with the dollars, if you say I'm willing to pay, then you might get your way, maybe. Not guaranteed.
I think we'll move on. We'll take a quick break. We're back with more.
When I wake up, I'm gonna be the man who wakes up next to you. When I go out, yeah, I know I'm gonna be the man who goes along with you. If I get drunk, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who gets drunk next to you. And if I heaver, yeah, I know I'm gonna be the man who's heavering to you. But I would walk 500 miles and I would walk 500 more than be the man who walked 1,000 miles then fall out at your door. When I'm working, yes, I know I'm gonna be the man who's working hard for you. And when the money comes in for the work I do, I'll pass almost every penny on to you. When I come home, oh, I know I'm gonna be the man who comes back home to you. And if I go, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who's going over you. But I would walk 500 miles and I would walk 500 more than be a man who walks 1,000 miles. I'm lonely, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who's lonely without you. And when I'm dreaming, well, I know I'm gonna dream about the time when I'm with you. When I go out, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who goes along with you. And when I come home, yes, I know I'm gonna be the man who comes back home with you.
Yeah.
You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back, and we're talking to the guys from Hutchison Legal, both Con and Sam. Now, during that break, we played a from Safe and Equal Family Safety in Victoria talk about how you can help if somebody isn't safe at home. So we're talking about a bit of we're talking about family and violence. We've got a couple of CSAs here to do it. But tell us a bit about, I mean, what do people do in that situation? You know, sometimes it's very hard.
It is, yeah. So, I mean, I'm doing my experience with a firm called Your Lawyer, and we focus primarily on making claims to VOCAT, the Victims of Crime Assistance Tribunal, for people who have been...
But that's after the effect, isn't it?
It is after the effect, but it's not after a conviction or things like that. I won't get too much into it, but it's different than like a criminal trial. It's all about helping people who have been the victims of violent crime, and that includes family violence and things like that. And they can provide funding for things like counselling, safety-related expenses, so moving away to an extent, that kind of thing. And the thing I wanted to reiterate is just that if anyone's going through anything similar, please reach out to firms like ours, like other ones, because even if we can't help, we can definitely put you on the right path.
And I think one of the things with when you talk about family violence, everybody thinks of the punch and pushing people over, but it can be a lot more insidious than that, can't it?
It permeates into every aspect. It's abuse, a financial, emotional, physical, takes over all forms. It really does. And if anything like that is happening, please reach out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess it's really easy to sit here and say, look, get yourself out, because sometimes these things happen.
It's so difficult.
And, 12 o'clock at night, 1 in the morning.
Yes.
I guess the first thing you should do is ring the police. Don't put up with it.
Mm. Correct. Yes, definitely. Mm. Definitely get the police, report it. Police have got a very difficult job to do. They're turning up in the middle of the night in people's houses. And there are stories, though, where it's very complicated for them to decide what should we do here. And the police have the power to go to court and issue a safety notice, even if the two partners don't want an intervention order. The police can go get one to protect the person that they think is the victim in that situation, the person that's been assaulted, suffered the violence. And it's definitely something you need to get advice about. If the police do that and you want to change it, you definitely need a lawyer to advise how do you do that. Hutchinson Legal can help with that. And sometimes, people want to get them varied and changed because of their life circumstances as well. So you need to know how to do that. But definitely, if you need the safety, if you need the protection, apply for it yourself. If the police won't do it for some reason as well, get the help and reach out to the social workers, social services. Yep. You should definitely reach out to get that support. And the victims of crime can, as Sam said, get you some counselling in the immediate aftermath of what the traumatic event that you've been through.
I guess there's two things there, that when it does happen, if you are under threat, and then you should make the triple O. I mean, I can remember, and I think I've said this before, that when I was growing up, if a husband and wife were having a fight, people walked away and let them go because that was their business. And the police, many years ago, didn't know, they weren't equipped to do it. Yep. They just didn't do much about it. But now I can tell you it's very high on their list. If they get a call that there's domestic violence, that takes priority over everything.
Yes, pretty much. And I think with the renewed emphasis in the media at the moment, and the government has pretty much directed them to give that top priority and step in and intervene. Yeah. Unfortunately, though, there's some cases where they've chosen the wrong person as the perpetrator.
Yep.
And the person who says, I'm the victim here, gets charged. So you've got to be very careful. And once an intervention order is done, it's a very serious criminal offence to breach it.
Yeah, you can't, can you?
So be very, very careful. Unfortunately, there's situations where people are sort of lured into breaching an intervention order that's against them.
Yep.
So please be very, as soon as you hear that word that it might apply to you, get advice. You need to make sure you don't breach it at all.
All right, we'll take a, pardon me, quick break. We've been a bit heavy this afternoon, but we're going to lighten it up a bit because we're going to send them over the question, and which has created a lot of interest. So we'll be interested next month to hear this one.
Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections. We're talking to Con and Sam. Righto, so we did, I think it was last month, Grant was in, and just during the conversation, we had a person rang in about bail. Now, I've had a number of cases, and Grant said, look, the presumption on bail is that, particularly with youth, it's a least intervention and all that. Well, I've had a number of people ring me since then. It created, as late as last Sunday, people are a bit concerned about this whole thing with the bail. So we'd like you to have a look at not what people think, but what the actual law is about giving bail, and also what sort of conditions they place on it, because we've heard of, I'm talking about bail for both adult and juniors, but with some of these, they're on bail the fifth and sixth time. So, I mean, at what is there a stage when a magistrate says enough's enough? Because some of them are on, you know, they get picked up by the police tonight, they get bailed today, tonight or tomorrow night they're picked up again. At what stage does the magistrate have to say enough's enough? And the other thing with the law is that some of these bail conditions are that you've got to report to the police station 3 times a week. Now, there's been a number of cases in the paper where the people have just not reported the police. So who follows them up? If the magistrate says, right, you've got to report 3 days a week, whose job is it to go and actually check that these people are turning up? Because from what I've read in the paper, some of them just aren't. They're just ignoring them. So what follow-up is there? Mm-hmm. How many times can people have bail? And what does the magistrate have to take into account? Because there must be, surely, a bottom line where you say eventually, enough's enough. I don't know. I got to say to you, and I'm not here to judge anything, the amount of calls I've had from people that are fed up with so much bail is unbelievable in the last 3 weeks since we spoke about it.
They're very good questions, and it's always, but I mean, crime, youth crime, bail conditions, it's always interests people for very good reason, and that's why it's always in the headlines. So it'd be a good research topic to find out what exactly the law is.
And yeah, we'd like to know that, because it's all right for us, or I don't say us, it's all right for the public to be jumping up and down saying, oh, this person had 6 lots of bail or whatever, if in fact they're totally entitled to it. And if the magistrate's looked at 3 or 4 things and says, yep, I'm going to do that, and I'll give you the 5th lot, then it would be handy for the public to know, well, this is why the decisions are being made, because he's looked at these factors. Because the public, I shouldn't say the public, the people who have spoken to me are saying, well, it's just a case of they get caught, they get bail, they're out the next day, and they do it 2 days later. So I guess we'd really like to not go on with what we think. It's more what the actual law says.
Definitely. And once you know what the law says, then you can have a more informed opinion about whether, because the law is meant to be community standards, everything that we stand for. And if it's something that, once we hopefully find out, best we can.
because at the moment, I'd suggest to you that the community doesn't think they're being listened to.
I think I'll just go out without answering those questions. Yep. We'll get them looked into and answered. But I'll just put a couple of thoughts out there, which is giving it a bit of a broader context, so not the law.
Yep.
But innocent until proven guilty?
Yeah.
Never forget that. It's vitally important.
I agree with that.
So crimes have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and so you should always start with innocent until proven guilty.
And I totally agree with that.
So,
but let's look at from the point of view where the police turn up and there's something happening right there, so they know exactly what's going on. Mm-hmm. So they know that the person's not innocent because they caught them doing it. So I take your point, and I totally agree with you. But is there a different sort of view that, if there is some sort of possibility they're not guilty, because that happens, is there a different lot of bail conditions to somebody where the police, hey, I got you, and we saw you do it?
No, until the conviction, innocent.
I will say, do we want police to decide who's guilty and who's not, or do we want that?
No, I suppose
that's
not.
That's like Judge Dredd. There's a movie called Judge Dredd where he serves both roles as policeman and judge and delivers immediate justice. Now, I don't think we want a society like that.
No, I suppose you're
right. But the other thing as well, the people who obviously want to feel safe and protected are also, without saying it, are saying they want the government to build huge facilities to lock people up in.
Yep.
And that's a huge cost, financial cost.
Yep.
And you are depriving someone of their liberty.
Liberty.
And so if you value your liberty and you value the concept that you're innocent till proven guilty, it really matters when you're the one being put under the microscope.
Yep.
I wouldn't ignore those concepts in this discussion, but that's a very broad view.
We've still got 2 or 3 minutes, and I wasn't going to cover this, but as we've got 2 or 3 minutes, talking legally now, we're talking about legally, not what we think. Mm. Out in the western suburbs, they've got people that are so frightened that at night they're getting banding together, neighbours, and they're touring the touring their housing estates on the hope that the fact that there's cars moving around, lights on and people are there, that the people that are doing these silly things will move on. So where do those people... We're not talking that they're armed guards. They haven't done security training. They are just a few people each night getting in a car, driving around. Mm. Where legally do they stand?
Well, we still do have the concept of a citizen's arrest, but any response has to be reasonable and proportionate. So you have to be very careful. I mean, this is a sort of a very American concept, community watch sort of thing, where they roam the neighbourhoods trying to, as you say, put off any people intending to commit a crime, trying to make them go somewhere else, make it someone else's problem, push them out of our area.
Yep.
I would say it wouldn't be just the western suburbs. There's many, many suburbs, east, west, north.
Well, I only mentioned the west because they were in the paper.
Yeah. Yep. So I wouldn't say it's always one area, but... Yep. I think that's very important to be very careful. So, like, we had those stabbing attacks, somebody with a knife at the shopping centre. That's happened in Sydney, happened in Melbourne.
Yep.
You're allowed to go disarm that person or grab them, restrain them, but you're not allowed to kick their head in until they're unconscious.
Right. So it's got to...
It's not... Well, if you've already restrained them, you can't then execute... vigilante justice on them because you'll be the one committing a crime on that person. Even though they started off committing a crime, you're now committing another crime.
Right.
Doesn't help. But you are allowed to defend yourself. You're allowed to protect others. So you could try and disarm them, restrain them, but then hold them until the police come.
Right. One quick question, because we're starting to run out of time and we've got on a subject that I didn't know we were going to get onto. All right, so is there a difference between a trained security officer and, so say, in that, we'll talk about in a plaza or anywhere you like, is there a difference between a trained security officer or you and me taking on that person? Has he got better protection than we have?
The public transport ones have legislation around them.
Yeah.
The private security in a shopping centre would be different to that. And the members of the public are different again.
Yeah.
Because you've got an employee, an authorised officer...
Who's trained.
And you've got a member of the public. So they're very different categories of what's expected of them in those circumstances. So something that a PSO could do, the one at the train stations, roaming around the train station, what they could be allowed to do would probably be a lot more than what you're allowed to do as an individual.
But what about the security?
The security guard, I think, somewhere in between.
Is he?
But they're an employee of a private business as well. So they're closer to the member of the public rather than the authorised
officer.
So they're just a deterrent. The private security guard is just a deterrent, like the people roaming the neighbourhood, shining lights on, keeping it bright to try and make the people intending to commit a crime to go elsewhere. So,
just to move them on.
Yeah.
All right, guys, look, it's fantastic to have you in yet again. We look forward to having someone from Hutchinson Legal in the second Wednesday of the month, next month, and to find out all about the bail conditions. But thank you for attending today.
Thanks, Alan. Always a pleasure.
Thanks.
Always.